Welcome. I'm Norma Walden, Chair of the International Relations Forum of the Commonwealth Club. It is now my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Reem Al-Alusi. She earned her master's degree in the History and Philosophy of Architecture from the University of Cambridge, where she wrote her thesis on the Eastern influences on the Italian High Baroque. Reem specializes in the art and architecture of Spain and Italy, the two points of contact for much Eastern influence, particularly via the Islamic Empire, into Europe during the early and Middle Ages. She has lectured on art and architecture in the UK and the US. By the way, today is her birthday. Please help me continue welcoming Reem Al-Alusi.
Thank you very much, Norma, for your kind wishes. I'll start if anybody wants to follow along from this line. Rome shows in whole and parcels all the rubble of wasted Egypt, giving pleasant trouble and most sweet rack to wits to know and see the mangled parent of antiquity. Egypt, mother of arts, who better might than here in the lap of science take delight? Gathered in Rome, dismembered perhaps too, appear far brighter than ever do. Gibbs, a Scottish contemporary of Milton, is making a powerful statement about the very roots of Western art. Contrary to currently popular belief, in which Rome dominates as the primary source of Western aesthetic culture, in early modern Europe, there were those who looked eastward with an impartial eye to reconsider the extent of the West's debt to Rome. Whatever position one takes in the debate over attributing Western civilization to exclusively Roman origin, or attributing it to more varied sources, one thing is clear. New discoveries and analysis demand our thoughtful attention and have seriously shaken confidence in the ultra-Roman point of view. Indeed, in this passage, we see a blueprint, as it were, for the formation of Western aesthetic culture. Egypt, a catch-all phrase for the wellspring of ancient Near Eastern, Middle Eastern, and Mediterranean culture, is the mother of art, who passes her knowledge on to her most precocious offspring, Renaissance Italy, where that knowledge is reconstructed, deconstructed, and disseminated. The result is an amalgamation of ancient philosophical wisdom and modern learning, conveyed via the medium of Eastern contact, that outshines either parent or child. Such is the story of art. On our journey of reconsideration today, I should like to start with a caveat. Unlike Gibbs, we must first rid ourselves of the mistaken notion of regarding either the East or the West or Christian or Islamic as single or comprehensive labels. They are not. The boundaries blur sometimes, such as in Western Islamic buildings or arts of other faiths that exhibit overtly Islamicizing influences. The truth is that during the Middle Ages, the Eastern Mediterranean was basically synonymous with the lands and culture of Islam. And so Islamic art, as we shall see, encompasses a myriad of cultural and, I would argue, religious precedents. Therefore, I use the word Islamic in its more complex civilizational sense. Let's start in the middle of time. Rome has fallen. Europe has been plunged into an age of ignorance. The fantastic thought and progress of the ancient world has, for the time being, been dispersed across monasteries and private libraries throughout Europe and the Near East. Some fear the past has been lost forever. However, in the East, a new power is rising, which will ultimately become one of the greatest superpowers, intellectual engines, and artistic geniuses the world will know. The name of this power, ironically, is submission, and it is the youngest of the three monotheistic faiths, Islam. In its dictum to seek knowledge even unto China, this entity will seek to collect, renew, and improve upon the immense learning of those who went before. In its turn, this entity will serve as a link to relay that inherited wisdom back to Europe. After sleeping through an age of darkness, this phenomenon will become known as the rebirth, the Renaissance. The diverse cultural context of the Near East into which Islam was born in the 7th century would come to have a catalytic effect upon the burgeoning faith. One of the most significant challenges facing the Islamic community was the necessity for the young religion to find a way to construct its identity in worldly material, in bricks and stone, while at the same time paying homage to the cultures that already existed in the area, many of which possessed ancient and rich artistic heritages already. From the ruins of Greco-Roman classical antiquity, this is the Parthenon, which itself actually served as a mosque for almost 200 years, to the soaring domes of the dying Byzantine Empire, to the ancient cultures of Mesopotamia, the land between two rivers. This is the Arch of Ctesiphon, the largest standing arch, to the bold colors and fantastic forms of the Indian subcontinent, to the glittering palaces of ancient Persia, to the pagoda-inspired parapets of China, the furthest reach of the Silk Road. This is a Chinese mosque. Notice how the pagoda tower has been adapted to function as a minaret. The art of Islam as a civilization by no means came into being in a cultural vacuum. To the contrary, the genius of medieval Near Eastern and Islamic art was its ability to adopt, adapt, and synthesize the cultures that came before into an aesthetic language that adequately represented the new religion and the region to the world. As a result of this synthesizing quality, which reflects the traditions of extant populations throughout the Near East, North Africa, and even stretching into the Far East, the art of the Islamic Empire played the role of an interlocutor, both temporally and geographically, taking these multitudinous influences, reworking them, refining them, and then transmitting them to Europe in a variety of means. Commercial contact, such as with the Venetian Republic. Martial contact, for example, the Crusader interventions in the Near East, as well as philosophical and intellectual borrowings, which will come to maturation in the humanistic inquiry of the Renaissance. The truth is that the exchange between East and West began in times long prior to the Renaissance. In Spain, for example, Islam was firmly established upon the very soil of Western Europe, and from the first exercised profound influences upon her art. Near Eastern and North African elements are a vital part of Spain's artistic language. Likewise, in Sicily, the two religions occupied common ground, while in North Africa and the Near East, more or less wholly Muslim at this time, but with significant minority Christian and Jewish populations. Merchant ships swept the Mediterranean from end to end, and her caravans and diplomats landed at the courts of Venice and Marseille. For example, many ceramic processes were introduced to Europe from the Near East via Spain, including lusterware, the technique of applying an iridescent glaze to ceramics. On the right is a Syrian lusterware vase, and on the left, a Spanish dish bearing an Italian family's coat of arms. Ironically, with the Crusades, a new era of cultural transmission opened. The half-mythical magnificence traditionally attributed to the Saracens, in other words, Syrians or Arabs, became a reality to astonished Christendom. A host drawn from every part of Europe came suddenly into close contact with the social and artistic order that vastly outranged the rather provincial limits of the medieval European experience. In every walk of life, the reactions to this contact with foreign progress soon became apparent, and in art, its results were by no means the least far-reaching. The new imports not only met newfound needs in an increasingly hierarchical social order in Europe, but also aroused emulation wherever they went, and opened subtle channels of artistic development that were destined to mature, if not immediately, then in the not-distant future. During the critical period when the West was emerging from medieval conditions, forces aroused and propagated by religious enthusiasm entered upon another phase of engagement, this time centered wholly in intellectual inquiry. This is what we know as the Renaissance. In the 15th century, European artisans and scholars, impelled by Eastern success, both in the intellectual sphere and in the sumptuous and lucrative arts that had become so essential to Renaissance splendor, turned with renewed interest to the East. This time, their gaze was directed not at the formal elements of art, that is, where we import a new form, but rather at the philosophical foundations I spoke of earlier. The geometric and mathematical basis of much Islamic non-representational art struck a deep chord in the collective consciousness of Renaissance scholars, who were just embarking on a journey of mathematical and scientific discovery of their own, not seen in Europe since Roman times. Moreover, the Spanish Inquisition was driving legions of the area's finest scholars and literati from the lush courts of Andalusia to the more fertile and tolerant soil of the Italian city-states. These thinkers arrived, toting their Arabic translations of Aristotle and Plato. In fact, many of these ancient texts would not have survived to the modern day without the Arabic intermediaries. Moved by deeper study of Islamic meanings and methodologies, Renaissance scholars and artists enlarged their own technical repertoire, but in so doing were no longer content to merely absorb such ornamental elements as they happened to come upon. They instead began to explore intently Muslim canons of design and to adapt them in a new spirit that was purely European in conception, yet in some cases almost entirely based upon the fundamentals of Islamic mathematical art. Indeed, the most prominent Renaissance man of them all, Leonardo da Vinci, was fascinated by the geometrical precepts inherent to Islamic art. In his notebooks, his vibrant numerical genius plays out in sketches of Near Eastern and Islamic patterns, such as the one here from Il Codice Atlantico. Indeed, his mathematics tutor, the Friar Luca Pacioli, we know to have traveled to Spain to study with the best teachers of the time in what was then Europe's hub of intellectual inquiry, Andalusia. Moreover, another Leonardo, Leonardo Fibonacci, the first European algebraist and father of the Fibonacci sequence, is recorded as having visited Egypt and Syria to benefit from the wealth of intellectual resources found there. That is a brief historical overview. Shall we look at some art? We looked briefly at some ceramics, an early import from the Near East to Spain. And there are simply far too many examples to do justice to them all, so I intend to focus just on a few of my favorites. The primacy of education in many Eastern centers dictated that the mode of communication of that knowledge, books, be just as adorned, be just as exquisite as the minds adorned by acquiring said knowledge, so a lucrative market developed for leather book covers and illustrated manuscripts. New techniques of working and dyeing leather were transferred to Europe via Venice. Here's an Islamicized Venetian example of a book cover from the 15th century. Here are some more. The one on the left is an example of the type of work pioneered in the Near East and exported to Venice. And here is another Venetian example, or Italian example, excuse me. The technique of illustrating manuscripts was probably gleaned from the gold-leaved written Qurans, or mushafs, that the Crusaders may have encountered in the Near East. Monks, of course, would eventually adapt this art form to serve the didactic needs of a basically illiterate population, illustrating sacred texts with scrolling arabesques and calligraphy. We'll see some calligraphy again a little bit later. It has been said that the Ottoman Empire was run on textiles. This, to me, is an incredible commentary on a society that, at its peak, encompassed territory larger than the continental United States. It was able to produce and sustain the lush standard of living for which it was known, based on its artistic production. On the left, we see a Turkish textile from the 15th century. Just as any good student must eventually outdo his teacher, throughout the 16th century, European and Turkish weavers took turns alternately outdoing their rivals, each producing patterns of unparalleled beauty and intricacy. The Italian ones, such as the one we see here in the center, tended to involve more floral elements, but they still retained the knot and loop patterning that we see clearly in the Turkish. Lastly, on the right is a weaving by William Morris, father of the arts and crafts movement in the late 19th century in Britain, in his attempt to revive the ancient patterning in decadent velvet. I love this kaftan. It's an early example of globalization. The silk was woven in Italy. It's the same as from the previous slide. It was lined in Istanbul, this gorgeous chartreuse, and worn by the doges of Venice for ceremonial purposes. The so-called major arts of the Renaissance were painting, sculpture, and architecture. With the exception of architecture, the major arts then reached their apogee in primarily representational mediums. Although the medium of framed portraiture and pictures did not have an analogous manifestation in the East, still, we find Eastern references in the works of the old masters everywhere we look. Here, for instance, is Titian's presentation of the Virgin in the temple. Titian is considered the greatest Venetian Renaissance painter. Look here, notice the pyramid in the background. There's no pyramid in Venice. Or the fact that the Doge's or Duke's palace is an almost exact replica of an Egyptian Mamluk style. Here's the Doge's palace in reality. Notice the variegated brick decorative, the variegated brick decorative patterning, the ornamental roof crenellation, and the arches, both pointed and lobed. These are typical Mamluk elements upon which many aspects of the Venetian Gothic, as the style is called, was based. So why all these references to Egypt? Well, you see, Venice was unique among the Italian city-states because of her prosperous trade relationships with the East, and she was eager to create every parallel she could in the imaginations of her citizens with Egypt, since her patron saint, Saint Mark of Alexandria, was, of course, Egyptian. Here is St. Mark preaching in Alexandria by Bellini with lo and behold, the Venetian Cathedral of St. Mark in the background. Here's St. Mark, the cathedral in Venice. Moreover, it served the Doges well to create some liturgical distance between themselves and the hungry, between their vast coffers, excuse me, and the hungry eyes of the church in Rome, by identifying with certain Eastern Orthodox religious practices, much like the Coptic Christians in Egypt. Hence, aligning the Venetian Republic with Egypt became a primary focus of the Venetian creation myth and a crucial part of Venice's self-identity. This is the house on the left of the Mori, or Arab brothers, in Venice, one of the city's most visible trading families. It reminds me of something I've seen a little closer to home. Other Italian painters took on Eastern elements for various reasons. One common theme we see in religious paintings is the incorporation of Eastern luxury goods, such as textiles, symbolizing not only superb beauty, but the opulence that befitted their sacred subject matter. Many painters depicted Turkish and Syrian designs when only the best would do. Here we see Fabriano's Madonna, enrobed in black with gorgeous gold embroidery around the hems, embroidery that seeks to emulate the Arabic calligraphy that may have once adorned such a silk. We see the pseudo script in the halo a little bit more clearly. Here is Piombo's cardinal with his geographers, clearly showing a Turkish carpet in the foreground. Here's the Turkish carpet. And here is the Turkish antecedent. Notice the banding pattern. It's practically identical. Piombo is probably trying to make a learned reference to Arab cartographers and navigators, still considered the finest in their field during the Renaissance. Now, it's been said that architecture is art's highest servant. It also happens to be my interest, so please forgive me if I move to architecture for the remainder of the talk. The first great built monument of the Islamic world is the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem. Sacred to pilgrims of the three monotheistic faiths, the challenge for the early Muslims was to build a structure that would welcome all believers. Rising off the Temple Mount, the plan of the Dome of the Rock is based on the principles of rotating squares, each set at 45 degrees to one another. The plan reflects the ancient mathematical esotericism of Plato and Pythagoras, who postulated that geometric forms were symbolic of the perfect, unchanging world of the hereafter, and in the Muslim conceptual edition, of the unity of the Creator. The three basic shapes, called the Platonic solids, the triangle, square, and hexagon, all result from manipulations of a circle, or a number of circles, which is the externalization of a point. So if you have a point, you turn it inside out, you have a circle, and hence the representation of divine unity. According to Plato, the triangle stands for human consciousness, or the trilateral reign of knowing, knower, and known over the human mind. The square, is used to symbolize the earth or materiality for the four cardinal directions, and the hexagon, the arc of heaven. So you see, the Greco-Roman tradition becomes apparent not just as a formal influence, that is where we borrow a form like a Corinthian column, but as a fundamental philosophical influence that is reworked to serve the liturgical needs of the new faith. The structure is topped by a majestic dome gilded in the Byzantine manner. The Dome of the Rock is basically a Byzantine building. The classical columns, topped by arches of striped black and white marble, and the arches, which are just starting to suggest the horseshoe shape for which Islamic architecture will become famous, as well as the gold and semi-precious stone mosaics that decorate the walls, all speak of a Byzantine heritage. The introduction of these Near Eastern elements into the West would come at the hands of the Crusaders and formed the artistic repertoire for two major periods or styles: the columns crowned by alternating striped arch stones and use of mosaic tiling would form the backbone of the style we know as the Romanesque in Italy. Here's the baptistry at Florence. The Carolinian in Germany. Here's the palace of the Crusader King Charlemagne at Aachen. And the Norman in England. Here's the cathedral at Durham, the first Norman church to utilize the new imports. Moreover, look here. We see the seeds of yet another architectural style in the seminal building as well. Notice the arches that are just starting to point at the top, at least a little bit. The pointed arch, like the horseshoe arch, will go on in history to become one of the recognizable trademarks of Islamic architecture. It will also, however, do a massive career shift and become one of the trademarks of Gothic architecture. Other arch forms that made their way west were the 3- and 5-lobed arches. Here we see a 5-lobed arch from the Great Mosque at Samarra in Iraq. The cloister doorways at Wells and Salisbury cathedrals closely resemble this. Here we see a 5-lobed arch from the Great Mosque of Cordoba on Corinthian columns, a polylobed arch from the Church of Le Souterrain in France, and a trefoil arch from Clay Church in Norfolk, England. Other Gothic borrowings include decorative crenellations. This is where the Crusaders would have shot their arrows down from before hiding behind the walled part. It's a common, very widely encountered architectural element in Near Eastern fortresses. It later became stylized until it ended up purely decorative. Here we see examples from the Cairene Mosque of Ibn Tulun on the top, a so-called Persian arch, and its decorative crenellation from the Mosque of Al-Azhar, again in Cairo. Another Egyptian example, as well as an example from the Tzadoro, the Palace of Gold in Venice. A very elaborate crenellation pattern from the Cromer Church in Norfolk, and finally, Oxford, Christ Church Hall, a Tudor arch. The pointed arch is called the Tudor arch in England. Here we see, this is the Tzadoro in Venice, perhaps the greatest expression of the Eastern imports to Venice, as well as Christ Church Hall, Oxford. Notice that pointed arch with its simpler crenellation pattern. The use of tracery in Gothic architecture, which is often geometric in nature, also likely developed from direct contact with Islamic architecture. Here's the Giralda Tower in Seville. This is tracery, by the way. It's two-dimensional ornament applied to the exterior of a building. Notice that I didn't say Near East. This is an element that probably came from Western Islamic buildings. The tracery on many Islamic domes and towers both resembles and anticipates later Gothic tracery. Here we see a line drawing of the bell tower at Evesham. Does anyone know where this is? It's at 235 Montgomery. And it utilizes tracery of the sort we see clearly at Evesham. Whoever would have guessed that Islamic architecture would make it this far west? Closely related to tracery is the art of calligraphy that became such a renowned part of Gothic art. It is likely that Gothic calligraphy was presupposed by Kufic inscriptions and manuscripts the Crusaders encountered on their Near Eastern journey. Architectural inscriptions served both an aesthetic and a didactic purpose in mosques and churches alike. Whoops, sorry. Here we have an inscription in Arabic at the Mosque of Sultan Hassan in Cairo, another Arabic inscription from Egypt, and here an inscription in English from Norfolk, the Southacre Church. Here we have an English inscription from Yorkshire. Notice the geometric banding pattern. This is typical in Kufic calligraphy, as well as an inscription from the tomb of Richard II, the Crusader King, at Westminster. It's hard to tell sometimes where the English, where the Arabic ends and the English begin. So great are the similarities. Just to give you an idea of the type of building rising in the West before the advent of the Eastern imports, we have this, the Round Church in Cambridge, built about 400 years after the Dome of the Rock. This is a typical Saxon church of its time. The Saxons ruled England just before the Normans, and the Normans, of course, brought the Eastern imports. This is King's College Cathedral, built just 200 years later, after the Crusades have taken warriors from across Europe into the heart of the refined and technologically advanced civilizations of the East. As you can see, the development differential is simply too great to have happened independently or in isolation. The technology, ribbed vaults, extensive glazing, high towers, simply wasn't present in most of Europe. Interestingly, the Gothic style would enjoy a renaissance of its own, so to speak, sparked sometime in the late 19th century by the English rediscovery of the glory of Andalusia, as well as by parallel discoveries of ancient Egyptian and Mesopotamian tombs. These findings fueled an exoticist passion for Eastern decorative elements in the West. The style was called the Neo-Gothic in England and the Art Deco pretty much everywhere else. Here is St. Pancras King's Cross Station in London, and the building upon which it was based, the splashily rediscovered Great Mosque at Cordoba. Although we were relative newcomers to the game, we too jumped on this archaeological bandwagon and employed some of the same forms in our architecture. We all know where this is. These are the legendary movie houses in the Tenderloin. The Alcazar Palace was built as a Shriners Temple, but later became a theater. Clearly, San Francisco, too, felt the distant genius of Near Eastern aesthetic culture. Going back to the Great Mosque of Cordoba, built starting in 961, the Great Mosque of Cordoba was anointed at the outpost of the last survivor of the Umayyad Caliphate, and it boasts the largest hypostyle hall in Western Islam. A hypostyle hall is a large space punctuated at regular intervals by columns, which in turn support beams that hold up the roof. It gives the impression of a forest of columns and has been in use since antiquity. The important thing about a hypostyle hall is the ethic behind it. Because it is not axial, defined linearly along a single axis, the threat of social hierarchy creeping into the space of religious worship is greatly averted. Unlike in many axial churches, for example, the Gothic cathedrals that we've seen, space becomes holier, as it were, the closer one moves to the altar or reliquary. And these spaces were typically reserved for the royalty and nobility. A hypostyle hall, on the other hand, is a plainer arrangement in which a wide swath of area filled with people on Fridays faces toward, but not at, a mihrab niche on a single, relatively egalitarian plane. Here we see some interlocking arches, an interesting distinction between Gothic interlaced or interlocking arches and Islamic is that the Gothic ones are rarely load-bearing, whereas the Islamic ones tended to be structural. It's a fantastic feat of engineering, fairly early on also. One of the most striking features of the mosque is its dome. It consists of 8 parabolic arches interlocking and forming a net-like support structure. If we follow visually each arch, one arch from end to end, and then the next, and then the next, we will be caught up in a literally never-ending geometric web. The suggestion of infinity, you see, is ever-present. This motif proved to be highly popular throughout Spain and Europe. Here we see a Gothic version of the Rib Dome, as it's called, in Burgos, Spain. The Catholics have adapted it to fit their needs. And here, one of these domes is from the Great Mosque of Cordoba. One is from a 17th century Italian cathedral in Turin. Without looking at the captions, can anyone tell which is which? I would bet not. The similarity is too striking to be merely coincidence. It begs the question, then, of why? What motivated, in this case, the Theatines, to adopt such an overtly Islamic structural device? The answer lies in the social and in the religious and socio-political setting of Baroque Italy. Italy at this time was just recovering from the Reformation, which was a period of introspection and course correction for the Catholic Church. The 17th century, however, ushered in an era of renewed fortunes for the papacy in the form of the New World colonies, as well as new challenges that had to be faced in the form of scientific ideas and advancements that had to be integrated. Overall, the atmosphere at this time was one of exuberant extroversion and experimentation, with an interest in exotic lands and pushing the boundaries of the known to their limits. Hence, there was great eagerness in using information gathered from far-off places by the traveling orders, such as the Theatines or the Jesuits, and incorporating these elements into the artistic production of the period, called the Baroque. In the context of the larger Western Christian establishment, this is the philosophical bedrock underpinning the interest in Near Eastern artistic elements. Because the Near East is where Christ lived, where he walked and taught, those were the things he himself would have seen, and thus were considered worthy of emulation. However, unlike earlier times, not everyone in the Baroque had access to the Near East. So, they did their best, sometimes copying Western Islamic buildings, knowing that Islam had long enveloped the Holy Land in a blanket of tolerance and relative cooperation. The rationalization, of course, is that the Muslims, even Western ones, must have a better idea of Near Eastern precedents. So emulation was based on this association with the Holy Land. There's just one last thing that I'd like to talk about. Minarets, minarat. Here we see the progression of the square tower from North Africa to London, St. Marylebone. However, the minaret that I'd like to concentrate on, one of my all-time favorites, that of the Great Mosque at Samarra. This is one of the purest structures in architectural history, a conceptual feat if ever I saw one. Built fairly early on, it is truly unique and fitting within the cultural context because many see this spiraling structure as an Islamized version of the ziggurat, of course the iconic Mesopotamian building form. The interesting thing about this minaret is its impact both within the Dar al-Islam, the lands of Islam, and outside of it. This is the Ibn Tulun Mosque in Cairo, built just 30 years later. Notice how quickly the form has traveled in the days before digital communication, photography. I'd like to tell you a story now. It's not the story of the Tower of Babel, which I'm sure you all know, but the story of the representation of the tower. That story is the story of European appropriation of the spiral form to represent divine wisdom. You see, at first, the tower stood for all that is evil, arrogance, disobedience, presumptuousness in the face of God's commandments. However, sometime in between the Renaissance, the Middle Ages, and the Renaissance, the tower's meaning shifted, and it gradually came to take on a more positive connotation. The punishment of the many tongues, Babel, that God sent down to punish man actually came to be seen as a blessing and a fitting representation for the Catholic Church's missionary activities. The missionaries, of course, had to learn the language of the place they were going. It's called the doctrine of accommodation. So all of these missionaries, speaking all of these different languages, eventually came to be represented by the iconography of the Tower of Babel. The spiral structure held a special place in the European artistic imagination. Here we see a painting by Bruegel the Elder, a Flemish master. Here's an Italian version. Finally, fast forward to 17th century Rome, the Tower of Sant'Ivo alla Sapienza. It is adjoined to the Papal Academy, La Sapienza, where all of these traveling faithful would have gone to learn their languages. And its name means the Church of Divine Wisdom. This tower has puzzled people for centuries. It's completely unlike anything else in Rome. As you can see, learning and wisdom have now come to be associated with this helical structure. Here is the Christ child disputing with the learned men atop a helical throne. So it is really no wonder, then, that the architect of this building, Francesco Borromini, chose this ancient form to represent modern learning. If indeed there is something that I should like for us all to take away from the magnificent world of Eastern art, it is our interconnectedness. Western civilization is inextricably linked to the East and to Islam. They are part and parcel of the same historical continuum. There is no such thing as a clash of civilizations. The very concept is a clash of terms, as we have seen. I would like to emphasize, it is not my intention to insinuate that all Western art comes from Eastern sources. Far from it. It is the interplay of ideas that gives birth to innovation. It gave birth to the Renaissance, and it can spark intellectual vigor again today. Islamic art and architecture, and the Muslims themselves traditionally, played the role of the bridge, the glue of the grand mosaic, the cultural ambassadors, as it were, between the world of the ancients and the world of the moderns. In this sense, in the rediscovery and reincorporation of the old perennial wisdom which has served as a guide to man through the ages, the principles of Islamic art do not then just belong in the East or to Muslims, but to men of all ages and climes, whose purpose it is the pursuit of true beauty. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Reem, for that excellent talk and the beautiful illustrations. We have time for some audience questions if the audience has questions.
Yes? Is this the origin of Celtic art?
This. The geometric forms, you mean the Celtic knots and the that's what many people say, the Black Irish, of course. That's what they say. It's highly likely, if you look at, for example, the crosses, many of the early Irish crosses, they have Arabic calligraphy or forms very clearly written in them. It is likely that early navigators made it up there. Yes, this is something that is, of course, very much a subject of debate, but I would venture in my limited knowledge to put my money on that, yeah. It could have even been earlier than Spain, so Spain might not have had anything to do with it. It could have gone straight from Africa, actually, or Egypt. Actually, the navigators, of course, in the Arab world were some of the finest of the time, of the ancient world, so it's likely that they made it to Ireland without going overland. Yes. It is Kufic refers to a specific calligraphy style in Arabic. So it wasn't actually, it is an English inscription, but it is very similar to the Kufic form. So in other words, these long, geometric looking, the risers and the parts that go down, very similar to the form of the calligraphy, but it's not actually Kufic calligraphy. Yes, please. Yes. Yes. Yes, a little bit. Oh, that's a fantastic question. You know, I'm not enough acquainted with it. I'm sorry. Forgive me. But that's a fantastic question. Some has been written about it. It just wasn't my field. I'm sorry. Yes. Bakhtiar, that's precisely the one that I would look at. Leyla Bakhtiar, Sufi, what's it called? Sufi, Sufism. It's just called Sufism. No? It's not? Okay. Okay. I have it too. Yes, please. Yes. Yes, oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. You know, that's a really interesting question because the Temple of Solomon, of course, is supposed to be heaven on earth, right? Well, this, the Temple of Solomon, like the Breidenbach woodcut that we saw from the Crusades, the Temple of Solomon was a seminal building, and a lot of Renaissance and Gothic architecture is based on this supposed connection, sonic connection to heaven. So a lot in the Baroque especially, they love to look at this Temple of Solomon. The interesting thing is that the Temple of Solomon's not there to our knowledge. What were they looking at? They looked at the Dome of the Rock. That is the building we saw in the center, supposedly the Temple of Solomon. So many churches, many cathedrals, because there's kind of this historical disconnect, they tended to look at the Dome of the Rock, heaven on earth, importing it to Europe. It became kind of this, it became an icon of a sort, the representation of heaven on earth. So yeah, the Church of Santa Maria della Salute, for example, in Venice, another octagonal, building based almost entirely on the Dome of the Rock. You can see it. It's a fairly obvious connection. That's a very good question. Did I answer that? Okay. Yes. Any effect on materials? That's an interesting question. The truth is that in many areas of the so-called Islamic world, wood, for example, is just not present. So stucco, adobe-like substances tended to take its place. Wood and brick, stone, these are area specifics. I would say that it's probably more of a regional manifestation as opposed to a philosophical one. In other words, I wouldn't necessarily know that there's a reason to use stucco as opposed to wood, other than just the presence of the material. Now, having said that, different styles are definitely We know that form follows function, generally speaking. So different styles will generally, they'll generally adapt to the material that are present. For example, the Gothic towers, we couldn't have built those out of adobe. But the reason they made it in Europe, in England, is because of the stone. So I don't know, I hope that answers that. I don't know, in other words, that Islamic architecture necessarily, I don't know that there's any meaning to the materials other than that they used what was present. And then the styles developed accordingly. Yes. Precisely, yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think the one you're talking about is San Vitale in Ravenna. It's Romanesque. And as we saw, the use of the mosaic tiling, very visually, it's considered to be one of the most Eastern of the Romanesque churches. It's one of the earliest also. So yes, the use of the tiling, the stripes, the polychrome marble, very much in line with Romanesque borrowings. Absolutely. Yes. That's a really interesting question. The Chahar Bagh, the four-part garden. Of course, the Islamic idea or representation of heaven is a garden, Jannah. So the garden is actually the locus of an incredible amount of thought and attention just lavished on these gardens. So my understanding, again, I don't know too much about gardens or landscape, but the four-part garden may have made it into the formal garden, such as Versailles, some of these fantastic, with the waterways. The Chahar Bagh is a four-part garden that has a waterway down the middle and technically another partition, sometimes with water, sometimes without, bisecting the first line. It's likely that this very formal setup, and it was always the same, always four quadrants, was somehow related to the formal garden in Europe. In Versailles, the example that I'm thinking of, and very formal geometric patterns and very kind of rigidly defined axes. It's likely, but again, I don't know, I can't give you precise names or dates. Yes. Did you have a question?
I wanted to just comment. The fact that we see in San Francisco, and I went to Cornell, the same thing there with the red and the white and the arches. We have to thank Washington Irving for the time he spent in Spain. And those buildings were becoming more decrepit at the time. Mm-hmm. And the Spanish government, after that, I think, had an interest of Washington Irving around.
Right. Absolutely. It was a rather splashy rediscovery for that reason, I think, because Washington Irving did turn our attention back to these monuments of a period of Spain's history that was gone, but really gone and forgotten. But he kind of made us remember again. It was very splashy with the gypsies and very exotic. And yeah, Carmen, yes. Yes, please. That's it. That is the title. Yeah. That's all right. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes, please. I would love to. It's a whole nother topic. It's a whole nother talk. I was really not sure whether I should bring China into this, so I just brought it in very cursorily, but there is the European conception of the Far East is minimal, to say the least. However, there's an enormous amount of connection via the Silk Road from the Far East to the Near East, to the Middle East. There's actually an immense amount of cross-pollination, as it were. The hexagonal shape, the I Ching, yes, there's... I don't know as much about it as I'd like to, but there is an enormous amount of connection. The Europeans did not have... I would say that the connection was filtered through the lens of the Near East. So many of the forms, even lacquerware, was generally thought of as being Persian. They didn't realize, in some cases, that it came from China. So it was kind of mediated through this Near Eastern lens.
Glad that she shared her birthday with us.